The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. What a lot to tell you on this Monday. Democrats make an attempt to outdo the rancor of the GOP debates, but fail. Nevertheless, the Clinton-Sanders-O'Malley contest has tangibly heated up. Also, Iran without most sanctions for the first time in more than three decades, and a release of prisoners in Tehran. But we begin today with the idea of due diligence. While markets rupture and fluctuate lately in the noisy wind of financial whims, we have a story for you of the difficulty of understanding an investment, any investment. Is it what it says it is? What is its impact on the people close to where your money may be going? This is a tale about the challenge of trust and verification of investments. We could have chosen many places in the world and many companies, but this hour we choose Brazil, which got some very good news a few years back.
Rio de Janeiro!
Rio de Janeiro!
The announcement of the Rio Olympics in 2009 heralded new investment interest in a nation known for political unrest, a booming economy, and a democracy still in the shadow of Brazil's history of military rule. Just like the World Cup tournament in Brazil in 2014, investors will see more of the nation than ever before. For U.S. audiences more interested in the Olympics than in the World Cup, the light will be on. Will the streets be swept of refuse? Polluted rivers and bays be detoxed? Will we see Brazil's environment under stress because of mining and development in the fragile Amazon and elsewhere? What will we see? More important, what will investors see? In the Amazon, there is good environmental news, but in the vast farmlands developed in the past 50 years, more question marks. Gustavo Oliveira is a doctoral candidate at the University of California, Berkeley, who studies Brazilian farmland development.
We've seen a very positive development of both Brazilian and international attention to the Amazon. The downside of that has been the absolute sacrifice of the Cerrado and other ecosystems in Brazil, especially the Cerrado, because that is the largest ecosystem where agribusiness has been expanding. During these last 30 years, Brazil surpassed the United States to become the leading exporter of soy. This has been associated with widespread deforestation and other type of environmental degradation in the Cerrado.
You can see a map of deforestation in this Cerrado region since 2010 on our website. Whose money does that represent? It turns out there are billions of U.S. pension dollars invested in Brazilian farmland, and one of the biggest players is the New York-based firm TIAA CREF, a company with a white-glove reputation for environmentally and politically responsible investment strategies. Here is Jose Minaya, a company senior executive, explaining on a conference call how Brazil is a real gold mine for farmland investment.
They have a lot of water in Brazil, and it rains at the right time. You get the right solar radiation. You get the ability of producing, in many cases, twice the crops that you can on a similar farm in the U.S., for example.
That was an investment call made back in August of 2015. As senior managing director and head of private markets asset management at TIAA CREF, he has an impact on the pensions of millions of Americans and more American teachers than any other institution in the world. Public radio employees have accounts with TIAA CREF, including me. They are a sponsor of this program. Are those investments in Brazil responsible? How can we find out? Is it knowable? A recent report from Grain, an international organization that supports local farms and local land ownership, found the company bypassed the 2010 law, which banned large-scale land purchases by foreign companies. You may have seen a report last November in the New York Times. Since the announcement of the Olympics and since Brazilian law changed, TIAA CREF has itself reported that its acreage there has more than doubled. 257,877 acres held in 2012 jumped to 633,391 acres by the start of 2015. The report from Grain also alleges some of that land was purchased from sources with a criminal background who were accused of stealing it from poor farmers before selling it to TIAA, CREF, and others. Devlin Kuyek, one of the lead researchers on the Grain Report, says this type of acquisition is illegal, and the fact that it's through unscrupulous landholders is in direct contradiction with TIAA CREF's white glove reputation.
It's really happened over the last two decades. Brazil has become a major exporter of soybeans and other commodities, particularly to China. Then also it's become a target for financial investors who are looking to acquire farmland as an asset. They see it as this sort of hedge that they can place in, against things like the stock market. And so since the financial crisis of 2008, you've had a lot of big actors from the financial industry who've been looking to acquire farmland, and Brazil is one of their main targets.
It appears from TIAA-CREF disclosures that the Brazilian holdings of the company have jumped from 257,000 acres in 2012 to more than 633,000 acres at the start of last year. I mean, that's a huge investment.
And yes, I think it's shocking for a lot of people once they see these numbers. TIAA-CREF manages these global farmland funds on behalf of other pension fund managers as well, and has really been a main actor in trying to push this forward as a sort of safe and responsible investment. And those land holdings pretty much doubled over those years at a time when Brazil was becoming exceedingly worried about this sort of inflow of foreign investment and acquisitions of the country's farmland, and had revised its legislation to put limits on what foreigners can acquire in terms of farmland in Brazil. And there's no way that this should have been able to happen under that law.
So you believe, and others in Brazil believe, that this company has violated Brazilian law in making these huge acquisitions?
Yeah, it created a complex structure and these sort of vehicles to skirt around the legislation. So, you know, the company would argue, well, there's nothing illegal about what we did, but it's clearly a violation of the spirit of the law. And the only reason for this complex, opaque company structure that they created was to have a vehicle that could get around the law and allow for TIAA-CREF to acquire farmland. And this area where TIAA-CREF has been focusing in its investments over the last few years especially, this is an area where indigenous people, small-scale farmers, tend to be situated and where they've occupied the land for generations. And in ways that, you know, the title is usually not clear. A lot of these lands are public lands. But these are areas where you have these sort of mafia-type figures who have been using violence, using fraud to claim those lands as their own in order to sell them to these foreign investors who are interested in acquiring those lands. So you have almost like an outsourcing of land grabbing to these local thugs.
Is there any way to know the level of displacement of indigenous peoples as a result of these acquisitions? And would you say that TIAA-CREF is a pioneer in this kind of investment and this kind of agricultural development?
These are pretty remote areas, and our colleagues from Brazil who were in that area were able to witness firsthand how entire areas of savanna where people had used for grazing their animals, the forests where people had used for hunting and gathering medicines, the major water sources for the areas, all those have been taken over by TIAA-CREF's sort of subsidiaries. And it's not just TIAA-CREF, but TIAA-CREF is such a powerful actor. I mean, it manages hundreds of billions of dollars. It has two farmland funds that combined manage $5 billion.
What would teachers who are pension holders at TIAA-CREF, and TIAA-CREF is a huge pension holder for public radio employees. They're a supporter of public radio programs. They certainly position themselves as a particular kind of brand. Do you believe that this would come as a surprise to people who hold TIAA-CREF pensions?
Well, of course it would, because TIAA-CREF is always talking about how responsible an investor it is, saying, you know, we practice strict due diligence. Don't worry, we ensure that the rights of indigenous communities are respected. We abide by the law. And yet, you know, the person that they're buying the land off in this area of Brazil is a well-known land grabber who's facing a number of investigations, who's been labeled by one of the local lawmakers as a murderer charged with assassination of at least two people. You know, if you're an investor in TIAA-CREF, if you're a pension holder in one of the funds that they manage, I think it's really important to write to them, to express your concern, and to demand that they at least, at a minimum, make public the farms that they hold. Because you know, the difference between what they're saying and what we found when we actually knew where those farms were, it was completely contradictory.
Devlin Kuyak is a researcher at Grain, an international organization that supports local land ownership around the world. Thank you so much, Devlin.
Thank you, John.
TIAA CREF company maps confirm they own land from Brazil's far east to the south. Some of that land is indeed in the savanna known as the Cerrado, one of the country's beautiful and vast natural ecosystems. Until now, TIAA CREF has not publicly responded to these allegations of questionable investments in Brazil, though they spoke with our partner, the New York Times, off the record, and have been quietly responding to investor worries about what TIAA CREF might be doing. Jose Minaya decided to respond to The Takeaway directly. Again, he's head of private markets asset management at TIAA CREF and claims 8% returns from these Brazilian investments. We asked him many questions. Are his company's land purchases in Brazil legal? Have they purchased land from people who got it by force, committing crimes to obtain land titles?
Less than 1% of holdings are owned by institutions like a TIAA CREF. So it's significant. It's growing. It merits the question of, what are these investors doing? Where are they? I think we like to take a leadership position in trying to educate and have that transparency. In terms of not being in compliance with the law, we are very thoughtful in how we create our structures. We believe and know that we're in compliance with the law, and we're transparent about what we do in Brazil. From a title perspective, our standards are very focused around not displacing individuals or indigenous people, respecting land rights as well as human rights. In our title search, we go back multiple owners to go back and see where really the origination of when that land was transferred. We go back and with the properties that we own, we check to make sure that they were converted. Even if it was converted 20, 30 years ago, we have the ability to know whether that was converted legally. We can also use intellectual property and satellite technology to go back and know exactly what was growing on those properties.
Can you respond to the specific allegation that you're working with an individual who's been accused of murder, who is a famous, ruthless land grabber in the region and has run afoul of the Brazilian authorities many times?
Yeah, and I would say, you know, our process is based on fact. It's not based on social media or rumor. But these are serious accusations. We take them serious. And in every property that we have acquired, we don't just do due diligence on that property. We do due diligence on the sellers, whether it's an individual or whether it's an entity. Now, the overwhelming majority of the people who we buy land from are actual farmers who stay on the land. But across the board, we do this. And when accusations come up, of course, we go back, make sure we didn't miss anything.
It occurs to me that, I mean, this is the first moment you've responded as a corporation mm-hmm. to these allegations. Why did you wait so long? The article came out in November. If you were absolutely convinced that you were comfortable being, first of all, outed by the New York Times and then comfortable defending your practices.
No, that's correct. And as I've said before, before we even made our first investment, we knew about these challenges in these markets. When we get an accusation like this, we're still informed by it. And like I said, we take it serious. So we then go through and validate.
What's your stake in the holding company down there? It's something like 70-80%?
We have a legal structure set up in Brazil
today.
And our goal with our structure in Brazil is to be legally compliant and in touch with the local community because it's a very local asset class. We're transparent, so you can go to our website. You can pull and see that we are, in fact, investing in Brazil. You could see that we're increasing our ability to invest there as well.
Do you have an average of how many years the hectares or acreages that you're involved in have been cultivated? You said 30 years, but that's just some.
So in terms of Brazil, most of our holdings in Brazil are in the Sao Paulo region. And that's a region that's been in production well north of 80 years, just a very long period of time.
Well, that's a region. That's a little imprecise. Do you know in terms of your own particular holdings?
So I'd say, you know, if Brazil is approximately 20% of our exposure, 80% of that is in a region like São Paulo, where there's been production well over 80 years. A smaller percentage is in the Cerrado region, which is on average been north of 15 to 20 years in production. You have some that have been as short as 10 years.
Nothing below 10?
I'd have to kind of think through it. There might be one or two farms that maybe were in production for 4 years. But the key there is these are not new regions. You can't look at it with a view of, oh, we just started developing this area 4 years ago. it's more expansion from where you've been existing, at, you know, tangential or adjacent kind of lots. Not that we are going to new areas, because we really don't have the ability to do that.
I'm a account holder at TIAA-CREF.
Thank you.
A lot of my colleagues are, and you're a contributor to public broadcasting and to public radio. With that said, isn't there a tension? I mean, who do you report to? I mean, I want the highest return on my account. Maybe I don't care about what's going on down in Brazil. But if there's some farmer who you say is of more concern than my money, how are you going to resolve that?
We are a long-term driven investor. This is not a strategy where you're getting really outsized returns. So it takes a longer time to get your money back, but you do it with the right stability. So that means that having the right environmental, social, and governance practices around assets like this are directly tied to our investment thesis for investing in those regions and in farmland in general.
So it's not one or the other?
With this asset class, it really cannot be one or the other, because if I buy land and I expect to get my capital back some point 20, 30 years from now, I need to maintain the integrity of that asset.
I've observed you listening to Kuyak and his accusations, and my impression is that your response, aside from the specifics that you said, is bring them on.
We stand behind our – and we have to stand behind our process, right? We understand that we're going to be held to a higher scrutiny by our stakeholders, our clients, and the community at large because of what we represent and who we represent. And I could tell you we're very confident in what we're doing in Brazil today.
Jose Minaya is Senior Managing Director and Head of Private Markets Asset Management at TIAA-CREF. Jose, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
If you want to hear more of Jose Minaya's interview, I urge you to go to our website. But there you have it. Are the investments responsible or not? Minaya makes a convincing case for the company, but Brazilian and UC Berkeley doctoral candidate Gustavo Oliveira says all the documentation in the world going back decades can't erase the fact that this is Brazil, not the neatly geometric cornfields of Iowa.
You might have someone that had a title for 5 hectares, and then 30 years ago, this person makes a quote-unquote transfer to someone else, and the title gets rewritten as 5,000 hectares. We have some states where if you add up the total area of all the titles granted in that state, that area is not just larger than the physical area of the state. Sometimes it's twice as large.
If you add up all the titles that are on the books, it actually represents double the land. So clearly there's something wrong here.
Yes, you might be able to point to a title that goes back 30 years ago, but that on its own doesn't demonstrate that the establishment of that title 30 years ago was legal in the first place.
Farmland is just one of the investment classes that will be open to greater scrutiny as the Olympics shines a light on where the billions in foreign investment is coming from and where it is going. These are tough times politically and economically for Brazil, and we'll be watching to see what else the light reveals. President Obama spent a few minutes this past weekend speaking to Tehran.
I do want to once again speak directly to the Iranian people. You, especially young Iranians, have the opportunity to begin building new ties with the world. We have a rare chance to pursue a new path, a different, better future that delivers progress for both our peoples and the wider world. That's the opportunity before the Iranian people. We need to take advantage of that.
The major components of the Iran nuclear deal were satisfied, and the U.S. and the international community lifted sanctions on Iran, some that had been in place for more than 30 years. At the same time, 4 American Iranians were freed in a prisoner swap as part of the deal, among them Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian. What does all this mean for Iranians anxious to restore connections between the U.S. and Iran? Shaheen Armin joins us from Tehran. He moved from Michigan back to Iran to be an entrepreneur. Shaheen, how will the lifting of sanctions affect you?
There is a great deal of anticipation here right now. Everybody feels that hopefully things will improve in Iran. When I came back here 3 years ago, by the time that my plane left the U.S. and by the time I landed here in Tehran, almost 24 hours later, the value of the currency, the Iranian currency, dropped by almost 60%. So when I landed here, there was a great deal of anxiety and among the people about what's going to happen. These were the effects of sanctions. and so many other things that was happening back 3 years ago. Now things have really changed. You know, it's Friday night. I was in this newly opened shopping mall in northern Tehran, and you couldn't believe it. The police actually stopped the traffic within a mile of this mall just to direct the flow of the cars and the people coming to see what's going on, you know, because the idea of a shopping mall is very new for Iranians.
What does this do to your art projects, your art deals, the deals you're trying to make to possibly even export Iranian cars to Iranians back here who are a little nostalgic about the goofy old Paycon?
Yes. Well, I just finished making a documentary about Paycon with my friend Sohrab Daryabandari, and the film was accepted at the Iran's International Documentary Film Festival back in December. We spent almost two years making this film, and Iran is a bit of a weird country. You know, there's a lot of contradiction here, and trying to understand Iran is probably difficult. So what we did is we tried to, with the story of the Paycon, we tried to review the past 50 years of Iran. The film is called Iran's Arrow, The Rise and Fall of Paycon. Paycon means arrow in Farsi. And it was a little unknown British car that was done by the Roots Group. And the car was introduced in Iran in 1967, and it really changed and transformed Iran in a big way.
Well, do you think John Kerry, Secretary of State, who's going to have to resolve and evaluate some of these contradictions in Iran, will be able to do so? And will these contradictions undermine the progress that you describe and that you can feel along with your young friends?
You know, John Kerry had a very tough job, so did the Iranian administration. They both worked really hard in the nuclear talks. You know, you have to give both credit because both sides, they were facing opposition, as you know, both in the U.S. and right here in Iran. So the talks are done. You know, the celebration was actually happened a few months ago when the talks were successful. So the announcement that the sanctions were lifted, there weren't like a lot of celebration in the streets or anything like that, because now people are waiting. Iranians are waiting to see what's going to happen next.
Well, $100 billion worth of sanctions coming off. That's got to end up in somebody's pocket besides in the government.
Well, that's what, you know, the average Iranians are hoping for. You know, we made this film during the sanctions. What we felt was the cost of living was just going up and up. And now it seems like this new wave of consumerism is starting. And understanding what this car did to Iran during those four decades that was produced is very important to understand Iran. I mean, if you want to do business with Iran, you got to understand Iran.
Shaheen Armin, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
In Tehran, Shaheen Armin is an entrepreneur who moved back to his country from Michigan. It was a different kind of verification being talked about in Vienna, Austria over the weekend. As we mentioned, the Iranian nuclear deal went live, and while entrepreneurs in Iran can rejoice over the lifting of nearly all sanctions and the resumption of oil sales, an upbeat but cautious Secretary of State John Kerry explained how this lifting of sanctions is not the end of the matter.
Let me underscore, verification remains, as it always has been, the backbone of this agreement. We welcome that Iran has followed through on the promises that it made. It has kept its word, and we will continue to do the same. But we will also remain vigilant in verifying Iran's compliance every hour of every day in the years ahead.
Four American Iranians being held prisoner were also released as part of this deal, something of a chilling reminder of why the sanctions were imposed in the first place back in November of 1979.
Our position must be clear. I am ordering that we discontinue purchasing of any oil from Iran for delivery to this country.
That's President Jimmy Carter imposing the first sanctions in the midst of the hostage crisis 35 years ago. Nicholas Burns is the former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs under President George W. Bush. He has, at best, a cautious welcome to the prisoner release and the lifting of these economic sanctions.
I think the problem we're going to have with Iran is we're dealing with two governments there. There is a reformist part of the government. But the Revolutionary Guard, and this is a group of very tough-minded, very cynical military leaders who report to the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, they're the people who are taking our Navy on in the Gulf. They're the people who are funding the wars, funding Hezbollah, funding President Assad in Syria, funding the Houthi rebels in Yemen. We need to push back against that part of the Iranian government. I don't mean in a warlike fashion, but be tough-minded in trying to contain them. And so I was very disappointed that they took our sailors captive, very disappointed they forced the apology. And this is not a friendly government, far from it. So I think some people are saying there's going to be a rapprochement between the United States and Iran. I don't see it coming yet.
Although, does this mark the shift between the U.S. relationship between Saudi Arabia as being the preeminent Middle Eastern relationship, taking Israel out of the question for a moment, and that Iran now is sort of the main relationship in the region? And of course, we have to notice that the Saudis have cut diplomatic ties with Iran.
I think the United States, you know, we have so many interests in the Middle East. We're going to have many points of contact. Egypt certainly continues to be a primary American partner. Turkey, a European country, but also a country with profound Middle East connections. You mentioned Israel. I don't think this diminishes the U.S.-Saudi relationship. In fact, the Saudi foreign minister has said very recently he wants to reconnect with the United States. We need a strong and stable Saudi Arabia. It's a very difficult ally because we have so many differences with them. Iran would like to become the most powerful country in the Middle East. That's the ambition of the Islamic Republic. They'd like to do that through military force in places like Yemen, Iraq, and Syria, and they want to do it politically. It's in our interest to talk to them. It's in our interest to work with them. It's in our interest to see if they can be part and challenge them to be part of the solution in ending the Syria war. But I don't think we should be under any illusions about what that government is. It has a reformist veneer, but it has a hardcore cynical anti-American center to it in the Supreme Leader and in the Revolutionary Guard. And this is the dichotomy and the real difficulty of balancing interests in diplomacy when you need to connect with an adversary, as Secretary Kerry has done so effectively. I think there's going to be a duality to the American approach. We're going to gingerly try to step forward and have a more mature, consistent relationship with Iran, but at the same time, Iran's going to be a problem for the United States. So this is a transition point. And we've seen nothing like this since 1979 when we broke relations with Iran.
We've gone from Ayatollah Khomeini to Supreme Leader Khamenei, but in the same 35-year period, there have been many more presidents. Would you say that Khamenei, who may not be long for this world, is the last Supreme Leader? Is there someone in the offing? Is the Supreme Leader mechanism going to have to go for there to be serious political reform in Iran?
Well, there's no indication that the Iranians will change their basic governing structure, which is that the Supreme Leader sits at the top of the government and has a tremendous authority to make the big decisions. And Khamenei, the current Supreme Leader, is resolutely anti-American. He's a bit of a recluse. He doesn't travel. He doesn't meet many world leaders. I don't believe he's ever met a senior American leader. He seems to believe that the United States is at the root of all the problems in the Middle East. He's mistaken in that. So until he passes from the scene, I think he's a brake on any kind of dramatic improvement in relations between the United States and Iran.
There's the pattern of pendulum swinging from hardline to apparent openness to there is no openness, back and forth for these 35 years. What assurance do we need internally that this is, in fact, a trend line that will stick as opposed to this oscillating cycle of ups and downs?
Well, we have an opportunity between two countries that have been divorced from each other since 79. Now to repair some of those divisions, to establish, and this is the elementary level of diplomacy, establish communications between our Secretary of State and their foreign minister. That's happening. Now I think, since the Iranians, in my view, have been consistent troublemakers, violent troublemakers in the Middle East, they need to reassure us that that page of their history will come to an end. I'm not so sure they're willing to do that. And the really difficult challenge for President Obama and for his successor will be, how do you balance those areas where we can work with the Iranians and those where we have to guard against Iranian actions if they continue to fund the most radical elements, terrorist groups and rebel groups that are tearing the Middle East apart. So I think you're going to see a kind of a forward-backward quality to our relations with Iran. There'll be some positive features. There'll be some negative features because the Iranian government is split. It's divided between reformers and reactionaries. I don't know who's going to win that power struggle.
Nicholas Burns, former American diplomat, professor at the Harvard Kennedy School, currently on leave at Stanford University. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
This Democratic presidential debate is the last meeting before the Iowa caucuses on February 1st. Melissa Watson is vice chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party. Melissa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So, Melissa, let me ask you an oddball question to begin with, since this is Martin Luther King Day. What do you think Martin Luther King Jr. would say about, in South Carolina, on stage, on national television, watching two white candidates debate the program of a black president?
I think he would be proud of the progress that we've made in this country so far. But I also think he would look ahead and see it, all the work we need to do moving forward.
How much did the debaters look ahead last night, do you think, or were they just going after each other?
It wasn't as visionary as some of the other debates I've seen, but I think with time winding down, they had to hit some hard points for now.
And South Carolina has figured prominently in the presidential contest. It's certainly going to be crucial for the GOP, and we saw a debate there just last week. And it's going to be extremely crucial for the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. Do you think he turned the corner at all, made the progress that he certainly shows in the polls in New Hampshire and Iowa stick in South Carolina? What do you think?
I really don't think so. I think in that respect, Senator Clinton had an advantage. She lost here big time in 2008, and I think she learned the lessons from her last loss here. And she invested heavily in this state and early in this state and put a lot of resources. So I think she started ahead of Bernie Sanders here, and I think it's going to pay off for her. I know that the debate played differently on TV than it did in the actual auditorium, but that room was clearly Hillary Clinton's advantage last night.
So even if pundits say that Bernie Sanders won the debate last night, the ground game is so big in South Carolina that it really played to Hillary Clinton's advantage, as far as you can see.
I do, but I also think that Hillary Clinton had to perform well. Bernie Sanders had to change minds. So the stakes were much higher for Senator Sanders than it was for Secretary Clinton.
Is there a suspicion of Senator Sanders on the part of Democratic voters in South Carolina, or is it just he's untried? He's a face people don't really know, and Hillary Clinton is someone they know very well.
No, I don't think voters are suspicious of Sanders. I think voters really like his message. He gets a lot of support here. If you go to his rallies, he has a lot of seasoned South Carolina Democratic politicos on his team. I just think he started late and that Secretary Clinton had more of an advantage than he has. He's been to South Carolina a lot. He came for several rallies for Fight for 15. He came and campaigned for Gloria Tinubu when she was running for the Congressional District 7 representative. So he's been in the state, but Clinton has more of a vested interest here and has done a better job, I think, on the ground than he has.
Forgetting for a moment the longstanding familiarity of Hillary Clinton among voters all over the United States and that not being the case so much for Bernie Sanders. You know, there are some who say that Bernie Sanders is just too liberal for the Democratic base in South Carolina and that Hillary, because just like Bill Clinton, this longstanding staking out of a centrist position in the Democratic Party, it's just not a movable state from the Clinton column. Is that the way you see it?
No, I don't. I don't think he's too liberal. I just think that people look at his policies and say that right now where we are, there are just unrealistic and wonder how we're going to pay for it. We like the idea of a free college in America, but we know right now it's not feasible. The community college bill that the president has currently proposed in Congress, it's going to cost $5 billion for people to get universal community college. And he's having a hard time just getting that through Congress. So imagine trying to get free college through Congress and paying for it without raising taxes. And I think Senator Clinton did a good job last night of making that contrast between what we'd like to do and what's reasonable and doable at this time in American history.
Melissa Watson, finally, before we go, did Hillary land any points, do you think, or land any punches on that question of the NRA and Bernie Sanders, given the wake of the Charleston shooting and what people are feeling about access to guns in America?
Well, this is a topic that hits home for us. It's personal, and it's even more personal in Charleston. The debate was held, as you know, almost directly across the street from Mother Emanuel. And a lot of people who attended the debate last night stopped back by there and paid their respects. And as you know, we had family members from Mother Emanuel inside the debate, some of whom I actually are friends with. And so because of the rawness of the emotion and just what we're feeling here with what we've gone through in South Carolina, I do think that on that point, she had an advantage. But I also think people are smart enough to see that Vermont is a different state. It's rural. We in South Carolina like to, some of our Democrats also like to protect hunters' rights to have guns.
Sure, sure.
But we do need to make a distinction between legal, law-abiding citizens and hunters' rights for guns and the need for AR-15. And I think Governor O'Malley did a good job of saying no reasonable hunter or respectable hunter hunts with AR-15. And that's the distinction that we need to make, and a distinction that the NRA is not allowing the Republicans to make.
Melissa Watson, a great sum up of the debate last night in South Carolina. Melissa Watson is vice chair of the South Carolina Democratic Party and was there. Thanks so much, Melissa.
Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. Good news if you're driving on this holiday Monday, you might want to turn up your heater and take a detour up to Houghton Lake, Michigan, where you can fill up your tank for as little as 95 cents a gallon or even 53 cents a gallon at the good old Beacon and Bridge Market, according to some national filling station monitors. The police are directing traffic on US 127 and Michigan Route 55 to deal with huge lines that are reminiscent of the 1973 oil embargo led by Iran. I remember lines in Michigan to fill up on gas that cost 19 cents a gallon a long time ago. The bad news, Houghton Lake is in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. That's more than 4 hours from Chicago, more than 11 hours from the New Jersey Turnpike, and more than 22 hours from Miami. A reminder that you can subscribe to the Takeaway podcast on iTunes and take us anywhere you drive. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Find us at iTunes or any other service you use to get podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.